Okay, welcome back. I hope everybody had a good weekend. So announcements, so experiment two will be this week as promised. I've got the doodle up and posted. There are just a smattering of times that I'm available posted on there. I hope at least one of those will work for every group. As before, please fill that out. Do one per group. So just one member, you can put your name or both names or all three names, whatever, that's fine. Okay. I selected times where I'm available and around. I'll have a TA down there manning like last experiment, but there are times where I will be here. So if there are any problems encountered, you can grab me and I can come down and see, or I might check in from time to time, but I don't plan to be there for all of them for the whole time. Because we're doing a smattering of times, register at least an hour before on the Duder poll, because if there's more times there than groups, I'm not going to ask my TA to go down there and wait for the whole hour in case somebody shows up. So if you haven't registered for a time at least an hour beforehand, then we just won't open the lab. Assume nobody wants to do it during that time. It'll be due a week from Friday, so they have 2 weeks to do it. Should be able to get it done this week is my hope, as long as you come in, find a time, have read through the lab beforehand and know what you're doing. Should be easy to get it done within 50 minutes. But we'll see how that goes. And then we do still have a homework this week. It's a bit of a shorter assignment. It's still three problems, but only certain subparts of them, and a couple of them are, shouldn't take as long as normal homework to accommodate that. Okay. So the experiment is to test now a full buck converter. In this case, we're going to be using gallium nitride sets, which I'll talk about in a moment here. The material the actual sets are made of, which is one of these wide band gap materials, which I've kind of mentioned briefly at various points throughout this course. So we're going to do some testing of that. Main goal is to be able to run comparisons between your analytical loss models that you solve using hand calculations as we do in the class, a simulation of the same converter, and your experimental measurements. People to rectify, okay, what's any difference in measured efficiency versus simulated efficiency versus hand calculated efficiency. This is a big part of design and research in power electronics converters. It's going through, when I want to figure out how to design a converter, I need to develop some sort of model of it that I can use to dictate, should my design have a big inductor, a small inductor, should I use these sets or those sets? Can use simulation to help with that, and then I go to build it, and the results are different from what I predicted. I need to figure out why so I can iterate on that design and make a good converter on my second attempt, perhaps. And then we're going to be taking what we did in the first experiment and actually hooking this thing up and running some manual maximum power point tracking. Okay. So here's kind of the circuit for experiment two. Everything in this outer gray box is a demo board that you'll be given. Has power stage. This is a synchronous buck converter. I do have MOSFETs. FETs for both devices. And then it's got the associated circuitry to drive them. So it's got this level shift, which shifts up a signal to drive the high side, a dead time insertion block, and then this LTC6992 is just a voltage controlled PWM modulator. So you can adjust the frequency, you can adjust the duty cycle. We're gonna adjust that duty cycle with just a potentiometer, the slide that you can turn. That'll control the duty cycle. There's an extra credit at the end of it to play with the frequency a little bit, change the switching frequency. They should default to around 100 kHz. Inductors and capacitors will be on there as well. Then external to it, we'll hook up the PV panel as we did in experiment one, the panel plus biasing source to emulate this photo current. It will be a current limited voltage source. And then at the output, we use the electronic load as a voltage sink to emulate charging a battery from this PV panel. Okay. This is what that demo board looks like. So we have power stage up here. This stuff has to do with the next experiment. This is that modulator with a resistor here, R6. Mentioned could be used an extra credit to set switching frequency. And then this big slide potentiometer, this thing lever slides back and forth to change the duty cycle. Okay. This is some mode selection, whether it's open loop or closed loop, with the jumper in the position it is. This thing is configured to operate in open loop, which is what we use for this experiment. Here, this is a chip that's doing some dead time insertion. A call from one of the old homeworks that I have a synchronous implementation, two FETs. It's possible to turn them both on at the same time. So I need to turn my one PWM waveform into two PWM waveforms, where always I turn off a device before I turn on a device to make sure I don't have them both on at the same time. And then this thing is this GAN power stage, which is actually a new part released in about a year ago maybe, that has two gallium nitride FETs, transistors, as well as a gate driver internally, level shift circuitry. Okay. And then here we have input capacitors, output capacitors, inductor, then banana jack hookups for everything. This is experiment 3 over here. Okay. So this GAN power stage, part number is LMG5200. Internally, what it has is these are the two power FETs. Okay. Then these things are basically buffers for the gate drivers, be able to turn the gate on quickly, bring VGS high, bring it low. And then some associated level shift circuitry and supply biasing. So that we can just send logic signals here to the low side and high side, and it'll take care of shifting it up and providing enough current to drive those quickly. Nice part that takes care of some intricacies of power converter design and layout. We get into in some detail in EC482, but just don't have the time here. So this is a single package chip. So this thing right here. And that'll take care of some of those details. So these are gallium nitride power FETs. Rather than being made from silicon, they're made from material gallium nitride, which is a different semiconductor. In the past decade or so, it's gained some popularity for power devices because the material has some inherent properties that allow it to exhibit superior performance. It can tolerate a much larger critical electric field before the material breaks down. It also has some additional material properties that help it switch very quickly, block high voltages and small size. So from a fundamental level, the material characteristics are superior to that of silicon when being used as a power FET device. The operation of it is quite different than that of the MOSFET that we've looked at before. Briefly, if you recall, chapter 3, where we went through cross sections of power devices. For a silicon power MOSFET, it was a vertical device, right? Conducted source at the top, drain at the bottom, and it conducted vertically through that. These GAN FETs are actually back to lateral devices, more like signal level MOSFETs. We've got gate, source, and drain all up top. This is some oxide, metal, gate material. It could be metal or some other conductor. And what you might notice here is there is built on a silicon substrate, but that has to do with crystal lattice structure and other things. This is not part of any kind of conduction pathway. So currents conduct, the gate turns on, we generate conductors, and current goes, drains the source laterally through this device. The interesting thing you might note is I haven't labeled any P-type doping, any N-type doping. And that's because this is not a device that has any doping inherently. Okay? It's actually not a MOSFET. It's what's known as a HEMT or a high electron mobility transistor. The way it works is between this interface here, between GaN and AlGaN, aluminum gallium nitride, because of the characteristics of the interface between GaN and AlGaN, what's generated here is a very high conductivity thin sheet layer that has very low resistance, a lot of free conductors. Okay. And that's just when I put these two together, that happens. So that's what's leveraged in this. Natively, there will be a whole lot of conductors, and I can conduct with very low resistance between drain and source. Some magic is used right here to get rid of those conductors natively, so that the device will be off if I don't apply a gate voltage. And then when I bring the gate voltage high, I'll pull in more conductors, complete it again, and have a conducting pathway. Okay. Magic is somewhat of a trade secret. The companies that make these have hinted at it, has options like plasma etching, selective P-type doping, recessed gate, other things. Not so important. The point is that it's not created by P and N-type doping, created by just this material interface between GaN and AlGaN. What that means, there is no P or N-type doping. There is no body diode. In a MOSFET, because we had this P and N type doping, we had parasitic PN junctions. One of those in particular realized as a diode between source and drain of the device. That gave us the body diode behavior. It was in a PN diode, so it had things like minority storage charge and potentially reverse recovery. This has no body diode, so it has no reverse recovery. The nice thing about it. Even though it doesn't have a body diode, it is not suddenly a four quadrant device. It cannot block voltage source to drain. The way this thing looks, sometimes draw it. This a little bit different of a symbol sometimes for this hemp, but still drain, gate, source. It still cannot block source to drain voltage. So let's say I try to do that by short gate and source to try to turn this device off, and then put a source to drain voltage on it. What actually happens is when I apply this negative voltage drain to source, or positive source to drain voltage, the gate and source are shorted together. So the voltage between gate and drain is equal to the source to drain voltage, which is much greater than zero. And I actually turn this device on, not by some body diode path, but actually the same way I turn it on normally, gate to source. I'm getting my gate to drain voltage above a threshold and turning on the channel by pulling carriers in here. So if I put a gate to source voltage above a threshold, I'll pull in carriers. Also, if I put a gate to drain voltage above a threshold, I'll pull in carriers. If I try to block negative source to drain, negative drain to source voltage will actually just turn on, not have a diode conduction. So it has a reverse conduction mechanism that I may be getting into details here. It kind of looks like a body diode. It'll behave like a body diode, but it's not a body diode. It looks like a duck and quacks like a duck. Sometimes it's not a duck. Okay. So those are a couple things about these GaN devices. In the end, the conduction of this, called a reverse conduction mechanism, one problem with this, so a nice thing is that it has no reverse recovery, no reverse recovery stored charge or transit time. Bad thing is this mechanism, because it has to do with thresholds rather than forward voltages, can be much more lossy than diode conduction through the body diode of a FET. Body diode of a FET might have a forward voltage of a volt. This might be 3 volts. It's not a conduction mechanism you want to use. So those are a little bit of the eccentricities of GaN. The nice thing about it, like I mentioned, is that the material characteristics are superior, so I can get a better device. I want to just kind of talk at high level about what that means by changing how I create this device. So we looked at this a little bit, kind of from a different angle in homeworks and then in the last problem of the midterm. We talked about, okay, you have these different devices and they scale in a certain way. Generally speaking, if I get a very low on resistance device, the way I get that is by using a big die area and paralleling up a bunch of conduction area so that I can get low resistance, put a lot of current through it. By making that die area very big, I make all of the capacitances very big. Okay? So a device that's very good at conducting is often very bad at switching. Very low on resistance comes at the expense of very high capacitance, very high stored charge. Okay. The trade-off gets worse as I go to higher voltages because I need a taller device. But generally, just on arbitrary qualitative axes here, if I look at on resistance, drain to source capacitance, and then blocking voltage of a device, I get a curve that looks something like this. And then this green dashed line is, okay, if I pick a blocking voltage, what I get is this. Blue is a bad color. I get a curve that looks like this, where I have some trade-off between R-on and CDS, and I can create a device that has very low CDS at the expense of very high R-on, or the other way around. I could get something that has very low R-on at the expense of high stored charge, stored parasitic capacitance. And then at some given curve, I can look at these different devices and do some optimization, like was on the midterm, where I say, okay, as I go to higher area devices, my conduction loss will get real low because my R-on is dropping. My switching loss will get real high because my capacitance is increasing. I go to very small devices, I'll have a lot of conduction loss, but very little switching loss. My capacitances are small. These small R is large. Out here, R is small. C is large. Somewhere in the middle, I'll have my best device where I minimize the sum of my different losses. Okay? That's true for any kind of technology for creating devices. What happens when we use something like gallium nitride is we shift that surface. Okay? We shift our optimal down. And that allows us then, when we design with these, to get now a different device that has some lower total loss if we can optimize the selection of the device. So if we can choose this one, it's much better. Now, both of these curves out here kind of hit the same resistance. Up here, they get to the same capacitance. So I can create a gallium nitride device that has the same resistance as some silicon device. The trade-off is going to be that gallium nitride device likely has smaller capacitance. So it's never just one metric. You can't say, well, resistance is smaller in GaN. It's always the trade-off between switching losses and energy loss, conduction performance and switching performance. Okay? And that's what these new materials buy us, wide band gap materials, things like gallium nitride, which is what we'll be using. Silicon carbide is another one of them that has more applications and higher voltage and higher power. Those are two that are commercial today. Okay, questions on that? Okay, not. So I want to show a couple of the things you'll be working with in the lab. So first, this is the kind of starter simulation that I've given out that you can download from the experiment webpage. It has a model of this GaN power stage, and then inductor, capacitor, voltage source, these things. Inductor, I've made just a normal, ideal 33 microhenry inductor, same thing for capacitor. You will need to go to the data sheet for this device and pick out what you think are important loss parameters about it. Okay. The power stage is using real models. If I open this up, open schematic, within there is a gate driver. Gate driver is of my design, just for simulation, to take a duty cycle and then generate gate drive signals for these two devices. But the devices themselves are real models of these GaN FETs. They'll already have all loss mechanisms included inside them. You don't need to tweak those. They should be. They're provided by the manufacturer. They're the best model they have for their own devices. Okay. So together, the driving source here is a PWM. So I give an example here where it's a pulse, and then I pull out switching frequency and duty cycle as their own parameters, so you can just adjust them down here. And that generates the PWM signal, goes between 0 and 1, and has a controllable duty cycle. Okay. If I just kind of run this, what I get, stop that. This waveform that looks like this. This is the inductor current, and it brings me to one point, which is addressed in the lab write-up, is how you start the system up. Okay, here I just turn the simulation on, figures out some initial voltages, and start switching right at time zero. At time zero, my output voltage is charged, but my input is not, because this capacitor is here and the PV panel hasn't turned on yet. That results in is, well, I've got some duty cycle here. This source is charged. This one is not. I get some big transient that causes my inductor current to ring up to 4 amps, even though that's way above what my maximum should be for this design in steady state. Right? This is exactly what it is. A 10-watt panel with 8 volts output. My steady state maximum current should be an amp and a half max. But now I ring up to 4 amps. Okay. This is a real thing that happens. If you go and you test your open loop converter and you just turn it on, bang, right from the start, you're going to get some large startup transient. And can actually solve that now as the step response of the GVD transfer function of your system. Okay. But this is bad. This is likely to damage something. If you damage these boards, I will not be happy. So the lab talks about it, but always bring your converter up, start at switching, and then slowly bring up the source. Don't turn it on with your source already powered, because then when you turn it on, you'll have some big transient. You turn it on and have it switching, and then slowly ramp up the input source, and there's no big transient. The system kind of immediately responds. It looks like it's always in steady state. Okay. So start up real slow. These simulation files, like I said, are available. You have to make some changes and then use these to test the same operating points that you test in the lab and then compare simulation efficiency versus experimental. One thing about measuring efficiency in simulation is your models for efficiency are steady state models. So if I try to measure the efficiency using this waveform, or only if I wanted to do efficiency, I would take output voltage times output current. Multiply those two. Here's my output power. Can I get efficiency from this? Well, I can't get anything while this thing's in transient, because what I'm going to get is I've got now power going to the output, but because it's in a transient, that power is going to include power which is going to charge my inductor, which is going to charge my capacitor, and that's actually not lost energy. If I do output power divided by input power, I might get 110%, because during that interval, energy was supplied back to my passives. I might get 50% because I put a bunch of energy into the inductor, but those aren't real numbers because that's not lost energy or gained energy. It's just transient energy that went into the inductor, would come back later. What you need to do is run your simulation long enough that all the waveforms are steadied out into steady state, and then take your efficiency measurement. For the same reasons, it's important that you do it over an integer number of periods. Even once this thing is in steady state, and I'm not going to get it there right now, because it'll take a while to let this run. Let's say I got close enough to steady state, then my power looks like this. If I control and click on some power, it'll give me the average power. If I have exactly n periods, here I'm pretty close, I have almost exactly 4 periods, then my average will make sense for those same reasons we just talked about. If I have some 1.5 periods, now the average of this is going to be off, because this more or less tracks my inductor current ripple. At the end of the period, my inductor current is lower than it was at the start, which means that energy has been net supplied over this time from the inductor. Okay, so it's not modeling the actual average steady state power. So make sure you're using, doesn't matter how many, but you have to be in steady state and using an integer number of periods. Okay, always. Compute efficiency by doing output power, then input power. It's just if you try to divide output power by input power and you have any time where instantaneously the input goes to zero, the results will explode. You typically calculate output power and input power, average them, and just divide them yourself. Okay, questions on SPICE?
Can you explain to us again why at the beginning the code is always so high?
So this is essentially what we just talked about in Chapter 8. If I just turn on the simulation, right, there is some initial step transient. Depends on exactly what the simulation solved for initial conditions. That's easier, let's talk about in the real system, okay? So if I set it up, apply my input voltage, get my input voltage to 20 volts, and then turn the converter on, what I have is a sudden transient where my duty cycle jumped from zero when the converter was off up to whatever I set it to, 50%, right? And so what I'm going to see at the output is the step response to my transfer function, GVD, right? What the system's actually seeing is a step in the duty cycle, some constant input. That step response, like we solved, is some, we did the buck boost. For the buck, it has no zero. It's still a second order complex pole pair in the denominator. So when I just do the step response to that, I'm going to get some ringing and oscillation. Equivalently, if I just have my buck converter on, I've got 20 volts at the input, and I turn it on with 50% duty cycle, initially the output's zero, right? So it wasn't on before I did that. So when it turns on, what's going to happen is I've got this input of 20 volts, I start switching, my switch node average is 10 volts, but the capacitor is 0 volts. So I'm going to, for those first few periods, just to be applying a large voltage across the inductor that's not balanced. It's going to ring up bring back. And the time domain description is the same thing. Until that output capacitor is charged, so I know 20 volts, 50% duty cycle, the output should be 10 volts, but initially it's not. And until it gets there, my steady state solution doesn't apply, right? Still in transient. Does that answer your question? Okay. And what you're doing by slowly ramping up the input is instead of providing a step input to the system, you're providing a very slow ramp that's much slower than that ringing frequency. So you never excite that ringing because you're changing things slower than its dynamics. Slow, anything you do is very slow relative to the electrical system, right? So your frequency is maybe a kilohertz, right? So as long as you're not ramping things at a rate where it seems like it's changing 1,000 times per second, you're okay, right? So you can kind of, okay, turn it up. Doesn't have to be little bit watch, just, you know, don't throw it, right? But reasonably slow is fine. Just don't turn it on with it already charged. This is the main takeaway. Okay. Okay. Final ambitious part. So what I have here, this is the best way I could find to actually see this thing, is this circuit. I'm not going to move that much because I think it's just going to make everyone nauseous. And I've attached two probes to it. This first one on the top here is going to this on my picture. So this pin right here of the header, the top right pin of this mode select, is the PWM signal that goes to the power stage. And that's talked about in the lab right up, top right pin, I mean that one. So that should be the PWM signal pulsing around. And then my second probe is attached to the switch node. The easiest way to do that is to come in from the bottom and hit the lead of the inductor. The other one is kind of on this lead of the inductor from the bottom of the board. Okay. So I have these two probes attached. Important thing about these probes, they have these ground alligator clips, these things. These are all true ground, earth ground back through the scope. It's something that I find people are confused about in some of their first laboratory experiments. So that on probe one, it's alligator clip, and on probe two, it's alligator clip, they are tied together through the scope. So I can't do things like measure the drain to source of the high side device with this type of probe. Because what I'll do is I'll take the switch node when I connect that clip to it and short it to ground. So all of these in any test setup have to all be connected to ground, and the probes can connect wherever. Okay, so be careful about that. These things are shorted together through the scope. Okay. Right now I have them both connected to ground, one on this ground, one on this ground. There's three grounds on this board, all of them are tied together, all the ground of the system. Okay. Like I said, I have things connected to, should be on channel one, the PWM voltage, and on channel two, the switch node voltage. This is a different scope than the one you'll be using in lab. This one's transportable. But I should be able to then turn this thing on. What I see down here on channel one is the PWM. Okay. Try this one more time. This. So as I move this slider back and forth. I'll adjust the duty cycle. I ask that you try not to go to 100% or 0%. Be careful, and you can go from 99 to 0. You go all the way to 100%. The gate driver has some problems. Should be non-destructive, but we'll stress the system. Okay, so that should give you almost the full range of the slider, allow you to adjust it back and forth. So this is just that PWM signal. I've turned on my VCC supply that allows that to run. I haven't turned on, this is the input voltage here. I turn on the input voltage. I will ramp it up slowly, a couple volts at a time. Then this top one now is the switch node voltage. Up to 10 volts, fine. Expand this out. Here's my switch node and my PWM signal. My PWM signal, 5 volts per division, a little bit greater than 5 volts. Switch node, also 5 volts per division, a little greater than 10 volts. What you may notice is that real systems, none of these things look like the perfect square wave that we sketch on paper. It has to do with the parasitics in the system. Everything's got a little bit of inductance, a little bit of capacitance. And we try to put these very fast switching signals that can excite those small parasitics. Okay. Inductor we have is 33 micro. Parasitic inductances may be a nano or two. It doesn't mess with the main operation. It doesn't influence the inductance, but we'll see it at these sharp edges. Okay. If I zoom in real close, you see that there is some delay between when the PWM changes and when we see the switch node change. That's the dead time that's inserted. So when this changes, propagates through and shuts off the first device, some amount of time later, turns on the high side device, making sure that there is no overlap between the two. A bit of dead time where neither are conducting. Same thing on the other edge, at the falling edge, a little bit of delay. This edge always comes first, so I can have delay through, dead time, and then drop. If I mess up a little bit more. Now I've got 20 volts at the input, bringing up to about 30 volts. Maximum voltage for the devices in this chip is 80 volts. We're still pretty okay, still more than 100% safety margin. Okay. Questions on that? Yellow trace is a switch node voltage. It is the node in between the two sets in the inductor. Let's see. So here, yellow is this, red is that one, just the signal level PWM, and then the switch node voltage. Okay. More often than not, the switch node voltage is one of the things you want to be looking at when you're debugging power converters, just because it lets you see kind of a lot about what's going on with the converter. The switch node voltage going to the input, and then is it dropping down to zero? Is the duty cycle right? Is the ringing bad? If you're only looking at things out here at the DC voltages, you might have big problems with your switching that you're not seeing. You're only looking at gate drives. You don't know if you're getting the right output voltage. This one, switch node voltages tend to be, particularly as you have some experience in looking at these, ones that give you a lot of insight into what's going on, can help you debug, keep that on the scope. Okay. The goal in the lab is to figure out, okay, based on your measurements in experiment one, with this sort of setup, we've got a buck converter feeding a output battery. What duty cycle should I set it to at the different insulation levels to get the maximum power out of it? I can, of course, play with that a little bit and do some measurements of power and see where it goes. But for a few different insulation levels, I'm asking you to set the duty cycles to get the maximum power out of the panel, then measure the efficiency of your system. That's what you use in the modeling efforts for the write-up. Okay. Any questions? Okay. If not, I'm going to power down. Plan from there is then to move on and talk about Chapter 9. Do a quick introduction of what we're going to talk about in Chapter 9. Chapter 9 covers controller design. What we're going to look at is, now that we know the transfer functions of the converter, we know a little bit about the transfer functions in the feedback loop, how do we put these things together and figure out what this feedback is going to do to my system behavior? We have good models of the open loop behavior with the transfer functions we've derived. And kind of inverting that, if I know how this feedback is going to affect my converter behavior, how can I design it to get advantageous converter behavior? Do so by examination of the loop gain, this quantity T, and then look at how to design things that are stable and have good transient response, good well-regulated characteristics. Okay. So that'll be the beginning of Chapter 9. We'll begin talking about this stuff next time. When there, a little bit early today, go over often enough that I can give you this one, and I need a little bit of time to clean up. Okay. We'll pick up there on Wednesday. Please coordinate with your group and fill out the doodle poll schedule when you're going to be doing the lab.